Call the meeting to order. This is a state government finance meeting for Thursday, February 24th. And I see we have a quorum, so would someone move the minutes from yesterday? Representative Banyan moves the minutes from yesterday. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried, and the minutes are approved. We have two major presentations on our agenda today. The first is the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and Major General Shelato, would you please come forward and welcome, Major General.
Chair Lanning and committee members, my name is Larry Shelato. I am a newly appointed commissioner of the Veterans Affairs. And today I'm going to just briefly introduce my staff, and they will go through. The presentation will consist of what I'm learning. I'm on a powerful learning curve on Veterans Affairs, having for the last 7 years been producing or making veterans. Now I'm taking care of them. And the question was asked of me this morning is, do I like the job? And I love it. And probably the biggest thing I've learned is for 7 years I focused on that 18 to 22-year-old group to enlist them, train them, and deploy them, I guess. We're in Veterans Affairs, we have the full spectrum. And with that, the presentation will talk about that spectrum from 18 years old all the way to a veteran I just visited in the hospital at 94. So with that, the veterans in the state of Minnesota, we have a comprehensive strategic plan, which will be gone over, but more importantly, we'll be talking about the two primary areas of our program and services component, taking care of the immediate needs, and then our veterans homes, which is the big ticket item in our agency. We estimate over 400,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota, ranging from no demands or needs on us to pretty intensive full care needs. And we have veterans serving in all 84 counties in the state of Minnesota, along with our county veteran service officers that are assigned to take care of them. So with that, I would like to start out by introducing Bill Acevedo. By the way, Mike Michelhenny is my PowerPoint expert and really the committee's point of contact for the agency. But Gil Acevedo is the head of our Veterans Homes component, and he will present that. And with him will be Reggie Worlds, who has our program and services. And when they will do it quickly, and then we'll be followed by Sherry Kronscheider, who is the budget expert, and they'll go through that in detail. So subject to your questions.
Okay. Gil? Welcome, and please, who's going next? Please identify yourself for the record, if you would.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gil Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare for the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. I oversee the five veterans homes here in the state, and as we go through the presentation, I'll just give an overview of each of the home, and we'll get into more detail about the finances or the funding of the homes as Ms. Kronscheider goes through her portion of the presentation as well. First of all, I want to thank you for the invitation to be able to present our homes and our department to you. The Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs in 2007 merged with the Veterans Homes Board, which made the Department of Veteran Affairs including the Veterans Homes. Prior to November 2007, the Veterans Home Board was a 9-member volunteer board that was the governance for the Minnesota Veterans Homes. The main characteristics of the homes is we have the average age for the skilled nursing is 78. They're predominantly male World War II veterans, and the type of care that we provide is Alzheimer's disease, dementia care with behavior disturbance, and organic brain syndrome. The residents that we have in our skilled nursing, we have two types of care. One is skilled nursing, the other one is domiciliary or boarding care. The skilled nursing population come from different nursing homes prior to coming to us, where the family placed them in a nursing home, and then for personal reasons or reasons that they decide, they transfer them over to us, or they have them on our waiting list to come to our veterans home. The characteristics for our domiciliary is average age is 58, much younger group that we take care of at the domiciliary level. They're predominantly male. Most of them are Vietnam veterans. However, we are seeing some current war veterans coming to our home as well. The three types or characteristics that we take care of in our domiciliary is alcohol dependence, schizophrenia disorder, and affective psychosis with depression. Oftentimes, these residents come to us from a homeless situation, but not in all cases. The focus on quality at the veterans' homes, we spent a lot of time discussing and going into person-centered care, which is now a national standard in long-term care and in nursing homes. This allows residents and families to be involved in their care and in their care planning. We have kind of communities, neighborhood-type approach. They foster close relationships with the caregivers, and food is prepared and served kind of in a family setting, so it's more of a person-centered care. We have several construction projects throughout the state. Just about all our homes, with the exception of Hastings, is in a construction status. Silver Bay was a middle school that was converted into a veterans home. We did a complete renovation on the interior. Fergus Falls has an additional 21-bed, which is a Alzheimer's dementia unit for them. The Minneapolis home has a new 100-bed nursing home that's being built, along with renovation of an old 1800 building to turn it into an adult day program. We have a future vision for Hastings, and we're looking at how do we want to operate Hastings in the future. And at the Laverne Veterans Home, we're renovating the front entrance to put in a covered entrance, so that when residents and family members have to go or they go someplace, or they go to medical appointments, as they're getting ready to load onto the transportation or buses, they're covered so they're not exposed to the element. The first home that I want to talk about is the Minneapolis home. It was established in 1887. It's a 341-bed skilled nursing and a 61-bed domiciliary. The skilled nursing bed is 24-hour nursing care, where our domiciliary is more boarding care, and the description that I gave earlier about those with that come from homelessness are predominantly those. Private, semi-private rooms, and the administrator is Shelley Kendrick. The Hastings Veterans Home was established in 1978. This was an old state hospital that was converted into a veterans home at Hastings. It's a 200-bed domiciliary. This is our largest domiciliary in the state, and it has 120 acres of campus throughout. We do chemical dependency counseling, vocational rehab. We have a really nice wood shop out there that the residents love, and they do a lot of work. And the wood shop, they do work for not only across the state of Minnesota, but across the United States. They send out flag cases and other things that they make. The money that they receive from the sales of their wood shop goes right back into their wood shop, so they can continue to do things like purchase wood and their tools for that. Currently, we have an interim administrator, Robin Gustad. She works for our department as our quality director, but she's there temporarily. We are going through a process of hiring a new administrator, and I've received resumes and going through that process as we speak. The Silver Bay Veterans Home was established in 1991. As I mentioned, it was a middle school that was converted into a state veterans home. No matter how we tried to make the place look like home, it still looked like a middle school. And so we had a complete renovation just recently, and the renovation turned the home more into a person-centered care. If you see pictures of the before and after, it's just absolutely amazing. It's an 83-bed skilled nursing unit. We have 25 beds that are dementia in particular. They're 50 miles northeast of Duluth, and the current administrator is Carol Gilbertson. The Laverne Veterans Home was established in 1994. It's an 85-bed skilled nursing unit. We have a Wander unit for dementia as well, and then the administrator there is Michael Bond. This is in the southwest corner of the state. Again, a very beautiful home when you walk in and you look at it. The Fergus Falls Home was established in 1997. It's an 85-bed, currently 85-bed skilled nursing unit. We are adding an additional 21 beds of dementia Alzheimer's care. That's the special care unit component that we're adding. As a community-based outpatient clinic, which is operated and funded by the federal VA, United States Department of Veteran Affairs, the Fergus Falls Home was the first in the nation to have a community-based outpatient clinic in a nursing home, in a veteran's home, and that was operated by a nurse practitioner as well. We have interior open-air recreational areas, an award-winning nursing care where we have our caregivers there are also doing dietary work, housekeeping work, nurse's aid type work, and it really gives that whole family approach to the unit. And the administrator is Mr. John Skillingstead. The waiting list for the homes, we do have a waiting list. We have a waiting list for the Fergus Falls home, which is 154 beds. We hope with the addition of the 21 bed that will help a little bit there. The Hastings home is a domiciliary. The waiting list is zero, and the reason that we do not have a waiting list at the Hastings home, that population is a little different, those veterans. It's hard sometimes to really, as we do a lot of outreach, to find the veterans that are in homelessness and those that really do not want to come to the home for care. And so we get referrals oftentimes, but we're trying to work on a better way to identify capturing those veterans that are out there. Laverne has 88 on their waiting list, and the Minneapolis home, which has both domiciliary and skilled nursing, as you notice in the domiciliary, we have no waiting list, as I mentioned in Hastings, and the skilled nursing unit has 207. Once we open the new 100 bed, we will start looking at renovating some of our other buildings as well. And Silver Bay currently has 66 beds. I mentioned construction. I just want to point out that the construction projects that we have at the homes, we always look to try to get a federal match to that. And whenever we do new construction or renovation or anything we do with our veterans' homes, we put in for a grant from the VA, and that's 65% of the building cost, or 65% that is reimbursed for the renovation.
Representative Kahn.
What about the success in getting those grants? Do you always get them?
What's Mr. Chair, Representative, we put in all our grants that we put in. Once we get the 35% commitment from the state, we are very successful at getting those grants. If we submit for the grants and we do not have the 35% commitment, then we generally don't get the grant and we end up on a waiting list. And I'm sorry, but to also answer an additional portion of the question is, if we pay 100% of the cost, for instance, if the state pays 100% of a renovation cost, we submit a request for reimbursement, and we've been very successful of getting our 65% from the federal government at that point.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like precise numbers on very successful, unusually successful, and that kind of thing. I'd like to know exactly the times when it's been turned down under either circumstances. Thank you. Not now, but
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I don't know if Ms. Promschroder has that in her numbers, but we can easily get those numbers to you.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Okay, and that concludes my portion of the state veterans' homes. If there are any questions, if not, Mr. Worlds will.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Acevedo. the veterans' homes, you have a number of FTEs, people that are working there. Is that mostly state-funded, or is that a combination of federal and state money that supports your employment?
Mr. Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the funding that we use to pay for, and Ms. Promschroder will go into this in detail, but we do receive federal funding through VA per diem. It's a per day cost or reimbursement that we get from the VA. We also have what the residents are able to pay by statute, what they're able to pay for their care. And then we have state funds that pays for, which comes from general fund, is appropriated to the department, that we also pay for the funding of the home. Most of our funding for our staff, it comes from our general fund. But we do have access to our VA per diem. We do have access from our self-pay from the residents. So it all comes in together, and so portions of that could be used to pay our staff as well. But we do not get direct federal funding for our staff specifically.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Acevedo, have you, are your homes fully manned as far as enough people to for nursing and other things that are needed at all five of your homes?
Mr. Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, our homes right now, I would say the answer to that question would be no, because we're actually ramping up for that 21 bed, so we'll be adding additional staff for that 21 bed at Fergus Falls. But across our homes, as it stands right now, we staff based on acuity, meaning based on the our residents' conditions or their care needs. And so we want to make sure that we provide appropriate care for them. So across the board, we were at a point about 3 years ago where we were not staffed appropriately, but I think now we're pretty much staffed at an appropriate level, given that we need to expand with the 21 bed and adding our adult day as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Acevedo. Are there programs that you are working at now as far as maybe combining programs to make them more efficient or more effective within the homes that you know, you're got plans for future to maybe combine things and make it more effective for the residents or your staff and the way you do things at present?
Mr. Acevedo.
Chair, Representative Anderson, we're always looking at ways to improve our process. Going into a person-centered care approach is going to help in that, because we're looking at trying to combine our efforts and do more community or person-centered type approach for our residents. Whereas if you had staff that kept moving around from unit to unit to unit, they don't have that consistency or that continuity of care within our residents. That's just one example. The example that I gave about our universal worker. The universal worker is a staff that can do nursing care, as far as nursing assistance care. They can also do things with providing housekeeping, providing dietary needs, and those type of things. And as we redesign our units so that we can actually cook close to the unit that they live in, instead of transporting the residents to the main dining room that you would see in an institutionalized setting, that reduces time. That also gives us more time so that we can be more efficient with our residents as well. Some other things that we're looking at, we're going into Medicare, Medicaid certification. We're developing our centralized pharmacy, where all our pharmaceuticals will be dispensed from one pharmacy, centralized location. We're also, with that process, looking to improve our ability to bring in third-party payers or revenue outside of state funds. So we're looking at a number of things to improve our process. Our quality council is constantly looking at things such as diabetes studies, other types of studies that we can not only take care of our residents here, but look at best practices across the nation and at other state veterans homes and other nursing homes across the state and across the nation. Just recently, our veterans homes received an award from Aging Services of Minnesota for our improvement and ideas that we've come up with for falls prevention at our veterans homes. So we're always looking at ways to improve.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Acevedo, you have quite an active waiting list here. I'm wondering what all these people are doing currently while they're waiting, number one. And number two, with such a big list, what time frame are we looking at these people being eligible or being capable of coming in? Is this going to take a year? Is it a 5-year? Or what's the chances of them getting in anytime soon?
Mr. Acevedo.
our waiting lists at our homes, the residents or the veterans that are on the waiting list are either at other nursing homes, they may be at home with their family taking care of them. It varies as to what their situations are. How long does it take for them to get into the home? Really depends on the attrition that we have at our veterans' homes. We probably at a rate of about 7 to 8 residents a month that we have that pass away, and most of those are World War II veterans that we're losing at an alarming rate across the nation. It can take anywhere from 4 to 6 months to get someone that's on the top of the waiting list in. So if somebody's at the end of the waiting list, that can take several months, if not years, to get into our home. That's why we're trying to come up with other avenues, such as adding the 21 bed to the Fergus Falls and doing things with the adult day so we can bring them into our veterans home so that we can work with them. But the VA also has contracted nursing homes, and I say the VA, it's the United States Department of Veteran Affairs. They have contracted nursing homes that veterans that qualify are eligible can go to those state veterans homes. There are foster care programs that the state has that the United States Department of Veteran Affairs has started in the state of Minnesota. That is also another avenue for family members. The VA has extended care, which is kind of a nursing home at the VA medical centers that they can go for your care as well. And then finally, they also have an adult day that that veterans can go to give the family members a break from caring for them day in and day out.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Are you comfortable with the service that you're providing for mental health in all your facilities?
Mr. Acevedo?
Mr. Chair, Representative. We are working on our mental health program. We expanded our mental health program at the Hastings home. 2 years ago, the legislature appropriated funding so that we can expand that process. We hired a psychiatrist and a nurse practitioner with mental health experience. So we're expanding that process. Am I happy with it? I would say no. I think we can always do better. And so we are looking at different avenues within the VA and in the private sector to try to better prepare ourselves as we start working through the behavioral health and mental health process. One of the concerns that we have at our veterans' homes that's a little different from nursing homes in the community is that we do have residents that have post-traumatic stress disorder or chemical dependency or other types of behavior or mental health concerns, but it's our job to try to take care of them in the best setting we can possibly do that. So we're always looking at ways to improve our behavior and mental health program.
Representative Kahn, and then we need to move on.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I've always, for the longest time, have been concerned about our concentration on veterans' homes. And I think that there may be a lot of people out there who would frankly much rather be cared for in a nursing home close to home or in their own home. And I wondered if we've done any surveys of the financial aspects of doing that, of can we get, maybe it requires a change in federal law or something like that, could we get the same kind of reimbursement that people get in veterans' homes? I know my father, who is a World War II veteran, always said he really wanted to end up in a veterans' home, but you know, at the end, he really wanted to be much closer to family and, you know, have care and own apartment and so forth. So isn't this something that we ought to be surveying or thinking about? And, you know, I know it seems to me that across the state, there are nursing homes with vacancies who could use additional support and so forth. So what have we done in trying to make this determination? And I also think that newer veterans might have different opinions about this than the World War One and World War Two veterans, which my father was. So,
Mr. Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, this has been discussed for many years, and the topic,
I know.
The topic comes up, and there are many answers to it. And to be honest with you, I don't know that it gets to a point And because it's a federal, it really is a federal issue, unless the state wants to get into it and basically say, if the feds aren't going to do it, then the state will do something. And I think that's where the discussion generally ends. The reimbursement, the VA per diem, that we receive at our state veterans' homes is specific to state veterans' homes as part of a sharing agreement with the VA, and it is by statute that it's the veterans that are being cared for at our home. We provide the primary care and the care for those residents. So even the residents that we have at our homes, even though they're qualified to go to the VA medical center, we are supposed to provide the primary care because we get paid a per diem for them, so to be cared for there. As for the VA per diem or other funding that can be given or provided to nursing homes in the community, if a veteran is qualifying, this is where Mr. Worlds will be able to answer this question very well in his presentation also. If a veteran is qualified or eligible for benefits and they talk to their county veteran service officers or talk to our department, we can try to capture as much of the benefits that they're entitled to. Things such as aid in attendance, for assistance in their care, and other types of things so that they can defer the costs. And depending on what their level of service connection is, if they are 50% or higher or 70% or higher, the VA will pay for certain things such as their medications or pay for their full cost of care in a nursing home if needed. So it really, there's multiple answers, multiple things to look at this. Are we looking at it? Every legislative session, I answer the same question, ma'am, and it really does depend on whether the federal government wants to embrace this and start providing more funding or if the state is going to do that. And again, capturing all the benefits for our veterans that are out there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I hear the federal government is having some budget problems, too. And, you know, isn't there some way to start this discussion in a serious manner? And maybe, you know, just with things like, instead of anecdotes, having surveys of what veterans want, having some real analysis of what the cost is. I just think that the states and the federal government together are in such a position that they have to not stop keep giving the same answers that they've given over the years. That's
Representative Loehmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Acevedo. I was just looking at the Hastings home, and it looks like you have 200 folks there. Is that full? You have 200 beds, but is that a full?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the right now currently at the Veterans Home in Hastings, we're at about 175. The capacity of the veterans home is 200 beds. We will probably, if we need to, we will fill all 200 beds. That there's no question there. But what we're trying to avoid is that the way it was designed for the 200 beds is that we would have 3 to 4 veterans in a room, and the quality of life for those veterans would diminish drastically. And since it was an old state hospital, their main shower room is down the hall, so it's not in their rooms per se. So we're trying to better the quality of life of our veterans so we can have 2 to a room versus 4 to a room. So we drop that number from 200 to 175. But if we have the need, we can always go up to 200.
Yeah, Representative Loehmer.
I have a follow-up, too. I was just noticing the FTEs are 106, so that's... Could you just talk about that a little bit? That's like...
Mr. Acevedo?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the FTEs, or the full-time equivalent, our staff, because we're a 24/7 operation, an FTE does not equate to one person. It could be, we can have several. So we can have somebody that is a 0.5 or a half-time. We can have someone that might be a permanent intermittent, that they come in at a 0.1, so they come in periodically. So the number of FTEs will show 106, but it may not necessarily be 106 people per se. Yeah. So I mean, it is 106 people. The FTE is showing the total number of equivalent. I guess Sherry will talk about that a little bit too, but hopefully I didn't confuse that. I hope not.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Acevedo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for the opportunity to present.
Thank you. Mr. Wells, please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Reggie Wurls, Deputy Commissioner for Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'd like to begin my program by saying that the Department of Veterans Affairs provides 16 different programs and service areas, which we will run through as quickly as possible in the interest of time. And, of course, we'll be able to answer questions at the end of the presentation. Our State Soldiers Assistance Program is one of the original programs that was established during the 1940s when the department was created. It is a program that provides direct or emergency financial assistance to veterans, dependents, and survivors. It is designed to assist our most vulnerable and needy veterans in the state. Applications are received at the department through our county veteran service officers and designated outreach staff from the department. Our Link Vet Line is a nation-leading program that provides information on veterans' benefits, health care, education, and reintegration. This line was established about 4 years ago in order for our returning veterans and current veterans in the state to be able to call in and get comprehensive information on health care, education, and reintegration. Also, referral sources for additional benefits that may not be provided by the federal VA or the State Department of Veterans Affairs. Our state-approved agency provides administrative oversight of the federal GI Bill's education and training programs. They are initially charged with going out to all of the individual colleges and looking at programs, ensuring that they can be certified so that veterans who want to achieve post-secondary education or go to a program that will provide an OJT or an apprenticeship program, that those programs meet federal standards. Our OJT and apprenticeship program was transferred to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs from the Department of Labor and Industry on October 1st, 2008. And we have then increased opportunities for veterans to use to earn educational benefits for on-the-job and an apprenticeship training. We have increased by 91% of the approved OJT apprenticeship since we took over the program. Our Higher Education Veterans Program was established in 2006 as well. This program assists all veterans from all conflicts and walks of life. There are so many different programs and funding options. This program helps students to navigate the system. The program consists of 12 representatives that cover 62 campuses across the state. In 2010, our reps made nearly 58,000 contacts with veteran students, a 31% increase over 2009. This is a very important program, which is set to sunset later this year, has a significant positive impact on our economy, and last year the state of Minnesota received $95 million in federal veteran and military education benefits. The Minnesota GI Bill provides post-secondary educational assistance to eligible Minnesota veterans, military members, and the children and spouses of deceased or severely disabled Minnesota veterans. This is a last dollar in program, meaning that veterans that wish to utilize or access this particular GI Bill must have expended all of their current GI Bill eligibility. The Surviving Spouse and Dependent Education Benefit, or War Survivor Benefit, provides survivors of Minnesota veterans who died as a result of service-connected injury or disease access to post-secondary education. For example, a veteran who was service-connected for type 2 diabetes and dies as a result of that condition, that veteran's family, his wife and his children, can then be provided post-secondary education free of charge at any state post-secondary institution. The Veterans Preference Act ensures that state-granted veteran preference rights are upheld and enforced. Our state veterans cemetery is located in Little Falls, Minnesota. This facility is one of the top veteran cemeteries in the country because we currently operate one of the state veteran cemeteries for the entire state. Our burials represent veterans from all over the state. As you can see through the graph, there has been a steady increase in burials over the past 15 years. We also have current legislation out where we're searching for 3 additional cemeteries across the state in Northeast, Southwest, and Southeast. The search to find a suitable place continues as we speak. Our department claims and outreach department is an additional example of a strong return on our investment. Our claims and outreach department brings in approximately $220 million annually in federal funds to the state of Minnesota through pensions and service-connected disability payments. Recent numbers from the St. Paul Regional Office estimates that there's over $267 million that are coming into the state as a result of efforts by the department, other service organizations, and the federal VA to increase the number of people filing claims or receiving benefits in the state. Currently, our department handles over 55% of the people that come forward for benefits. Our Tribal Veteran Service Officer programs provide service for veterans and their families on the Mille Lacs, Grand Portage, Boise Fort, Red Lake, White Earth, and Southwest Minnesota and metro areas. Native American veterans volunteer and serve at a much higher rate than any other population, 25% or higher versus 2% of the general population, yet they come forward to receive benefits at a lower rate than any other group. This is why this program was established, to get into the Native American culture, to work on the reservations, to build the trust that is necessary in order for us to adequately serve these brave veterans. The Minnesota CORE program is a nation-leading program designed to bring essential community-based services directly to veterans, service members, and family members across Minnesota. Due to its unique structure, this program will also provide resources to previously underserved rural areas around the state. By partnering with Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota, the CORE program is able to provide comprehensive assistance in the areas of individual and family counseling, with specialty service for children, deployed parents, financial counseling, debt management, addiction and substance abuse counseling, disability services, and in-home counseling. As you can see through this chart, the program has experienced increased usage since it was started in September 2009. The department has 2 grant programs for county veteran service officers, the enhancement grants and the operational grants. The enhancement grant is an annual open competitive grant process that all 87 counties plus the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Services Officers are eligible to apply for. These are an opportunity for county veteran service officers to enhance the benefits, programs, and services provided to veterans. It should also be noted that this grant is due to sunset this year. The operational grant program is provided to CVSOs triennially. This grant program is a set dollar amount based on veteran population in each county. Its purpose is to assist CVSOs in purchasing equipment for their offices. That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair and committee members. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to take them now.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you repeat the tribal tribes that you're involved with?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Wells?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're currently involved with the Mille Lacs, Grand Portage, Boys Fort, Red Lake, White Earth, and a Southwest Minnesota location that is currently vacant. And also, 2 tribal veteran service officers are located in the metro area.
Okay, so you don't have Leech Lake, Fond du Lac, or Midwakanda?
No, sir, we do not.
Okay. Are there, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Gauthier?
Are there plans to do that?
At this point, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
at this point, no, sir. When we originally started out with formulating our plan for this program, we approached all of the reservations to see what the level of participation would be. Initially, Fond du Lac wanted to be a part of it. However, they wanted the grant to come directly to the reservation versus having being under the control and oversight of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, so they chose not to. Leech Lake was a similar situation, and when we take a look at the reservation over in Shakopee, they really felt because of their financial status that this would not be of a benefit to them.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Worlds, you mentioned the sunset. Were you referring to the sunset for the campus service, the higher educational institution services that are provided? I know that is sunsetting this year. We had a bill just the other day in our committee that to consider eliminating that sunset and repealing the sunset. Were you referring to that, or were you referring to some program for county veteran service?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was referring to the county veteran service officer enhancement grants. Those are due to sunset this year.
And Mr. Worlds, what is the amount of that? Is this, and this is a state grant or federal?
This is a state grant, Mr. Chair.
And what is the amount of that?
That is $750,000 a year, sir.
Okay. The other question I have, and maybe your finance person needs to help answer this as well, but and we've asked other agencies for the same kind of response, that given the budget problems, the issues that the federal government is dealing with, are there any programs that if the federal government were to cease funding, that we would be forced either by law or necessity to pick up funding that the feds might end up cutting?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the majority of the dollars on the programs and services side are state, with the exception of our state approving agency, which is all federal funding. Our mission in life to take care of our veterans will hopefully get them federal dollars coming into the state. Our job is to sit down and interview all of our veterans that come in, that come forward, and to maximize any financial benefits that they're entitled to receive. So for the effort that we put out, or the state dollars that come in order for us to put the FTE out in our claims office, out in our benefits offices, we're going to see a substantial return on investment in federal dollars by assisting them and advocating for them to get the benefits that they're entitled to receive.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Next, testifier. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sherry Kromschutter. I am the Finance Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to come here today to go over the governor's recommendation for the department's fiscal year 12 and 13 biennial budget. I'll first start out with a brief overview of the department's finances, and then we'll go into more detail at the program level as well as the budget activities that are within those programs. The pie charts represent the department's expenditures, and it does not include a $2.8 million transfer biennially to the Office of Higher Education for the administration of the Minnesota GI Bill. And also, it's important to note that as we go through this presentation, the department has authority to combine resources and expend them from a separate fund for the purpose of providing services at our five state veterans' homes. And I just wanted to point out that with that authority, we transfer those funds into the miscellaneous special revenue account, and the budget pages will show our expenditures reported under that miscellaneous special revenue. However, it really is sources from the federal VA per diem that we receive at our veterans' homes for our residents' care, as well as the private payments and the state general fund. We'll start out first with the Programs and Services division of our department. And this program's fiscal year 12 and 13 total expenditures are expected to reach $32.2 million of all funds. Of that, $27.4 million is general fund direct appropriation. $2.6 million is that open appropriation to the Minnesota GI Bill, as well as $200,000 direct appropriation for the administration of the Minnesota GI Bill. In that $27.4 million general fund appropriation, $945,000 of that does include the governor's recommendation to provide funding ongoing for our higher education campus reps program that the Deputy Commissioner World spoke of earlier. The remaining $2 million is other funds, and those other funds are our cemetery development and maintenance, as well as our state approving agency federal reimbursement. This program has 89 FTEs and three budget activities. The budget activities are veteran services operations, approximately $5.2 million, and 21.7 FTE. The core services are provided there for this budget activity, and the second activity is our benefits and services, and that budget activity is appropriated $15 million in the biennium and has 19.6 FTE. This funds our State Soldiers Assistance Program, Minnesota Service Corps, Link Vet, State Cemetery, the Approving Agency, and the On-the-Job Training Program, as well as the budget activity for the GI Bill. And the last budget activity is our Claims and Outreach at $9.1 million in the biennium and 46.5 FTE. This slide will give you an overview of our federal fund summary for the Programs and Services Division. We expect to receive about just under $800,000 in the biennium for the operation of the state approving agency. The charts here will give you an overview of looking at this program's expenditures by fund, by expenditure category, and then also by activity, by budget activity. 93% of the program is general fund, and again, that funds our Veterans Services Administration, the Claims and Outreach, our Higher Education, Veterans Assistance Program, State Soldiers Assistance Program, Link Vet, the State Cemetery, Minnesota Service Corps, our CVSO operational grant, as well as the Minnesota GI Bill, and payment to our veteran service organizations, and grants to the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. The miscellaneous special revenue fund has burial fees for our state cemetery, as well as the Support Our Troops account, and our state soldiers, or our state approving agency's administrative portion of that federal reimbursement. And our federal funds are derived from the state approving agency, which is 100% reimbursed for the 4 FTE in that program. And we also do receive a burial allowance for veterans at our state cemetery. And the last fund is our gift account, our gift fund. And we do receive a small amount annually from the Proud to Be a Veteran license plate, and those funds are used to support the Veterans Day programming put on by the department. The expenditures by category, I would just like to point out that the payments to individuals, this is payments made via our State Soldiers Assistance Program. They provide cash assistance in the form of shelter payments. They pay utilities, personal needs, grants to veterans who are unable to work as a result of a temporary disability. And local assistance, that piece of the pie is for our grants to the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, or MACV, as well as service organizations and the CVSO operational grant. The expenditures by activity, the Veterans Services Operation receives $5.2 million, Veterans Benefits and Services, $15 million in the biennium, and the Claims and Outreach, $9.1 million in the biennium. The second program, and the largest of the department's programs, the Veterans Health Care, or we'll also refer to them as the Veterans Homes Program. They are 87% of our department's operating budget. And we're looking at $191.1 million in expenditures during the upcoming biennium. $88.7 million of that would be for general fund dollars. And within that general fund, we have $500,000 in each year allocated for repair and betterment at our five veterans' homes. Change items in our general fund, we're looking at $738,000 in fiscal year 13 and $842,000 in fiscal year 14 for the ongoing operations at the new Fergus Falls 21-bed Alzheimer's unit. The change item can be found on page 7 of the budget pages if you'd like a little more information or background. That project will increase our FTE by 31.5, and I've provided the bonding law to go along with the state funding for that. And the reason for the change in fiscal year 13 to 14, and the reason we are not asking for funding in fiscal year 12, is we have identified carry-forward dollars that we have earmarked to roll forward into fiscal year 12 to fund that operation as we go forward. However, those dollars are one-time in nature and will run short in fiscal year 13. And then we also have a Minneapolis adult daycare change item. We're looking at $162,000 in fiscal year 13 and $232,000 in fiscal year 14. That project will increase our FTE by approximately 13.5. And I've also provided the bonding law for the state bonding money for that project. And this, again, is the same nature as the Fergus Falls. We will be utilizing some of our carry-forward dollars to fund this program's operation into the fiscal year 12. Our non-general fund change items, we have changing the earmarks.
Excuse me, Representative Kahn has a question.
I'm not sure who this should be directed to, but my notes say that there was a 35% federal match for the construction of the 21-bed facility in Fergus Falls. Well, that's a different number from the 65% we were talking about earlier. What's the reason for those differences?
Ms. Crumschroder?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're referring to the construction portion, and this is for the operational dollars.
Oh, okay. No, this says construct. Okay. So
I was providing the legal citation so that you could see that construction project was approved back in 2006, and now we are now recognizing the operational tails as a result of that funding that was provided back in 2006.
Well, who said? I mean, I have notes, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I have notes which said there was a 35% federal match for construction. Is that just wrong? Was it a 65% match?
Ms. Crumshaw.
Federal match.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the construction phase, we do receive 65% federal match and 35% state match.
You may proceed.
The non-general fund change items is change in earmark established under the laws of 2010, Chapter 215, to redirect carry-forward earmark of $200,000 between the Fergus Falls 21-bed addition and the Minneapolis adult daycare. We're looking at the Fergus Falls project may be delayed approximately a month, and we would like to utilize that savings to help support the startup of the Minneapolis adult daycare, which is running on track. And then our second non-general fund related change item is the Veterans Home Service redesign. That change item is on budget page 10. And what we're looking at doing there is the HOMES program has looked at ways of creating operational efficiencies by generating additional revenue and by looking at reducing our expenditures to cover the ongoing compensation costs as we move forward into the next biennium for the unfunded insurance increases and performance increases that were approved by the bargaining units. And how we are looking at doing that is we'd like to bill Medicare and private insurance for residents who have voluntarily consented to enroll in the Medicare Part D prescription drug program. We're thinking between the biennium we could collect approximately $800,000 for that purpose. And renegotiating our physician services, professional technical contracts at the homes, requiring that successful contractors will bill for Medicare. And we are looking at approximately $350,000 for that purpose. And developing a standard practice related to resident maintenance fee adjustments. It is not a very large number, but we can recognize some savings there as well. And then reviewing resident records to determine eligibility for that higher rate of per diem. That is a veteran who is 70% or more service-connected or who requires nursing home care because of compensable service-connected disability of less than 70% is eligible for the lesser of the daily cost of care or the prevailing rate at the home. And so we feel that by reviewing the veterans' records, we may be able to generate some additional revenue by requesting that higher federal per diem rate. And we're looking at about $85,000 per year. We also have looked at our operating expenditures and some of the measures we've taken to reduce expenses in that area. We're looking at, or we've actually implemented, usage of multifunction devices and eliminating small desktop printers, saving costs on paper by scanning, imaging documents instead of printing them. We're looking at renegotiating our laundry contract at our Minneapolis Veterans Home and feel that we could see some savings there, as well as we have installed video conferencing equipment at our veterans' homes and our St. Paul office, and hope to reduce our travel costs by having training and meetings via the video conference.
We have a question from Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, congratulations. I mean, this is interesting. You've been able to find some. So, as I understand this particular change item, you've identified some places where you can be more efficient. And your request is to be allowed to use those funds internally to move back to help fund some of your operations. Do I understand that request correctly?
Ms. Kromschroder?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay, then. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question is simply, you don't see, because I see additional revenues being collected. Of this $321,000 you're looking at, how much of this is from further application to Part, getting people to voluntarily apply to Part D Medicare, and how much of this is from the efficiencies you've identified just in terms of operating the office?
Ms. Kromschroder?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the implementation of Medicare Part D we're looking at in the fiscal year 12 and 13 biennium, we're hoping to generate approximately $800,000 in revenue for that program. And then by renegotiating some of our physician contracts and putting in that the physician will then bill for the Medicare services, we're looking at approximately $350,000 in the biennium. And the operating expenditure reduction piece is $321,000 per year.
Thank you.
On Monday night, we're going to be hearing a bill that would authorize doing this in other agencies. So that's the QAM bill. Do you want to finish up in a couple of minutes so we can see if there are, we have to allow some time for our last presentation here too. So,
Mr. Chair, I will speak very quickly. All right, our HOMES program, our Veterans Healthcare Program, has approximately 1,041 FTE. And you'll see a reduction in the FTE into the future year, and that is a result of looking at our overall budget as a whole and in fiscal year 13, we're recognizing a shortfall. However, the department does feel, as we pick up momentum and move forward with the Medicare billing, that we will be successful in obtaining additional revenue to offset that shortfall. Our veterans home budget activities, I'll just briefly go through them. I have a lot of the information on the slide for you. Our Veterans Healthcare Administration, our five state-operated veterans homes. We have one in Minneapolis, which is looking to open a new adult daycare, our Hastings Veterans Home, our Silver Bay, Laverne, and Fergus Falls, which is looking to open that new 21-bed Alzheimer's unit. And also, just to point out one more time that the revenues from our federal VA per diem payments and resident maintenance charges, when combined with the general fund, consists of the operating budget for our five state veterans homes. And when you pull out all of the other pieces of the operations, that is approximately 54% general fund, 21% from resident maintenance or private payments, and 24% from the federal VA. The next slide is our federal fund summary. This is a list of all of our construction projects for fiscal year 10 through fiscal year 13, and we are looking at $25 million during the current biennium and $24 million into the next biennium. And here again is some charts that will show you the HOMES program or the Veterans Healthcare Program expenditures by fund, by category, and also by the HOMES allocation, so you can see how much each home is represented. And I will end there and answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kromschroder, I didn't notice here in the budget book anything, but you'd mentioned that you, I think under your pie chart, talking about different expenses and incomes, and you mentioned state support our troops account. Mm-hmm. How much money does the state bring in, or how much money do you bring in through that topic?
Ms. Kromschroder?
Mr. Chair, representatives, the state soldier or the support our troops plate account, we receive approximately, last year it was around $530,000, $540,000. However, the Department of Public Safety puts in an anticipated transfer each year of approximately $400,000. So we budget at $400,000, and then the actual receipts may come in slightly higher, slightly less.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Kromschroder, you could say $400,000 a year, you're pushing $1 million for the biennium.
Ms. Kromschroder.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no other questions, thank you very much for being here and for your explanation of the budget.
Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you.
Our last presentation today is from the Campaign Finance Board. Mr. Goldsmith, would you please come forward and identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm happy to be back. My name is Gary Goldsmith, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I had the opportunity to speak with you shortly after the beginning of this year's session to give an introduction to the board, plus you've all had some involvement with the board at one level or another, so I'm not going to go through that again. I really want to just cut right to the issue at hand, which is the budget. The board, as you know, handles campaign finance, lobbying, and economic interest, both from a regulatory and from a disclosure standpoint. We are an agency in the executive branch, although we don't consider ourselves to be one of the governor's agencies. The governor makes requests of us, and we try to fulfill those requests, but we're an independent board that the governor doesn't actually control. You give us our budget, and our board administers that budget. I'm going to start my presentation by way of background by reviewing some questions that came to the board in a letter. I think it went to all state agencies from the chair, I think, at the request of leadership, to address certain questions, and I'm going to use those questions as a kickoff to just give some background and general information about our funding. Then I want to take a couple of minutes just to make the people in this committee some of the most educated people on campaign finance funding that there will be in state government, short of your own fiscal staff and the board staff itself. Then I'll talk about our budget and the governor's recommendation, which happens to also be the board's recommendation. And finally, we've been asked to address some funding cut scenarios, which I will do at the end. Addressing the questions in the letter, and I'll be brief on these because they're short answers, this presentation will be a lot easier to follow, I think, than the previous one because the board is a lot simpler organization than the previous one. I also want to point out, though, that when you look at our budget, as opposed to one like you just talked about, or a large administrative agency within the state, remember that the figures on my spreadsheet are in $1, not in thousands of dollars. And don't take the position that because you can see more deeply into our budget, it might be worth cutting some $3,000 item, which you won't even see in somebody else's budget. We don't have any special revenue. We don't have any dedicated fees. All of the money that we collect in civil penalties and late filing fees goes right back to the state of Minnesota to the general fund. By the way, that amount is roughly $50,000 to $60,000 per year. The board would vigorously oppose tying collections of late filing fees and civil penalties to our budget or in any way having that money revert to our budget. We want our budget process to be separate from that so as to avoid any kind of conflict of interest in the carrying out of our duties. We don't have any federal money. We don't have statutory or open appropriations that deal with our operating budget, although we do for public subsidy, which I'll talk about a bit later. And also, we don't have the ability to carry forward money between bienniums. So what's left at the end of this year, and there will be money left at the end of this biennium, will revert to the general fund of the state. Like all agencies, we carry money forward between the 2 years of the biennium. And for us, that's very important because the way the biennial structure is and the way election years are, the election year is always in the second year of a biennium. So we try to accumulate some savings in the first year that accommodates the higher printing and postage and other loads that we have in the election year. One of the questions had to do with chargebacks from other state agencies, and I'm not sure exactly what that meant, but I do want to point out, and I'll mention it again further on in my discussion, that of our operating budget, $40,000 off the top, actually it's more than that, it's $45,000 approximately, goes in rent to the Department of Administration. And another significant amount goes to the Office of Enterprise Technology for the various computing and voice communication services we get from them. We don't have any chargebacks from the Attorney General's office. Under our statute in Chapter 10A, the AG's office provides services to the board without chargeback. One of the questions that was in the information request had to do with full-time equivalents, and I think that the board at least has operated responsibly in the area of its budget in general and of its staff level in particular. I went back to some reports the Minnesota Management and Budget publishes. They're on the internet on their site if you care to look at them yourselves. But they do reports on FTEs across the state. And they do a report that lists large agencies, medium agencies, and small agencies. There are 44 small agencies according to MBE criteria, MMB criteria. I'm not sure if that's 10 employees or less. I think it's 10 or 12, something like that. We are one of them. In 2005, we had 9 staff members. We now have 8, and that's a permanent reduction. That's 11%. So I went back and looked at Q4 of 2005 when I found us, and then I looked at all small agencies, and those small agencies had 363 employees, so it's well under 10 on average. And then I looked forward to 2010 Q2, which is the most recent figures, and we have now 8, so we're down by 11%. All small agencies together are still at 363, so no growth whatsoever in small agencies. I point that out because I believe that the small agencies are probably some of actually the best managed, because we know where every dollar we have is and where it's going to go. By contrast, I looked at all state agencies, and in Q4 of 2005, there were 31,108 employees, and at Q2 of 2010, there were 32,067, a 3% increase, and that's in a time when there was some version of a hiring freeze going on. So the problem in state government growth is not with the small agencies, and it's not with the Campaign Finance Board. I've included an org chart for your information. I won't go through that. You can take a look at it. We don't have any people in the commissioner's plan as far as compensation. I and Jeff Sigurdsson, who's sitting behind me, the assistant director, are in the managerial plan. So we're at manager level. We have no commissioners or deputy commissioners. We have three professional staff and two administrative staff. We do some agency rulemaking. We will not have any rules that are subject to the pending legislation that deals with rules that would have a financial impact on the people who are regulated. Our rules are to make things clearer and simpler for people to understand and comply with. We don't have any state vehicles that we regularly use. The last question on the letter had to do with pending lawsuits. There is one, you probably know about it, I think I mentioned it before, the new legislation regarding corporate money in independent expenditures has been challenged as not providing enough opportunity for corporate participation. That's a lawsuit that will not have a monetary damages verdict if there is one. It will be a declaration of what the law should be. There might possibly be attorney's fees, not for the Attorney General who's representing us, but if we were to lose, and we're cautiously optimistic that we will not lose, but there could be attorney's fees owed to the other side if that should happen. That concludes the materials that were in the letter requesting certain information. I want to turn to
Excuse me, Mr. Sure. Goldsmith, Representative Slawick, before you move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, you keep referring to a letter, and it's a letter that the majority party drafted, I think, and the minority party has not seen. And I wondered, Mr. Chair, if we could get a copy of the letters that went out.
Certainly.
I was a fiscal chair for the last 4 years, and we also sent letters. So I don't know if they're similar or not similar or what's in them, but if we're going to have testifiers addressing issues, it would be helpful to see how many you sent out. Are they identical, or are they... So yes. I don't know if we need one, just maybe a copy of one.
Yes, they're identical letters, and you'd be happy to provide that to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith, before you move on, if you would go back and just wanted to make sure that I understood your comments about fines, that is the on the... The summary, the budget summary, it indicates that total non-dedicated receipts for the last 2 years were $67,000 and $60,000. And for the next biennium, that's dropped down to $47,000 and $40,000. Is that all fine revenue? And it goes directly into the general fund, is what you're saying? It's not used within your agency?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I don't have a ready explanation for the drop, except I think we used an average. But that would all be late filing fees and civil penalties levied by the board. And by statute, those all go back to the general fund.
In that connection, are the fines we're imposing serving as a deterrent, a sufficient deterrent for people to comply?
Mr. Chair, members, I think at this point that they are. In fact, the board over its last meeting and at this next meeting that is on Tuesday is going to be reviewing imposition of certain fines that we at staff are recommending be reduced for first-time violations. The legislature in the last session increased the penalties for certain things. And they increased penalties for pre-election reports, particularly the 24-hour notice of a large contribution, That runs at $50 a day up to a maximum of $1,000. And with certain of those reports, like the large contribution, a person doesn't know they're in violation status until we get their report and we can tell them. By then, the fine is already $1,000. So we're looking at adjusting that down for a first-time violator. But I think that they are at a reasonable level now. The regular late filing fee for campaign finance was increased to $25 per day from $5 per day. The board is essentially looks at first-time violators and gives them a break. They also waive late filing fees for medical problems and other similar problems. But I think that they are sufficient now to be a deterrent.
Okay. You may proceed.
I want to take just a couple of minutes, as
I'm sorry, Representative Winkler had a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, I think I'm clear that you said that you currently have 8 staff members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, correct.
One issue that came up last year as we were trying to deal with the Citizens United case and the need for disclosure was the question of how much capacity the board has for investigative work. And I admire your desire to separate fines from your budget. But the question I have is, how prepared or how well suited is the board to actually be an active investigator in campaign finance violations? And in particular, I anticipate that we're going to have growing complexity of mechanisms for independent expenditures as groups try to avoid sunshine and try to avoid having to disclose sources of funds. I imagine that we're going to get ever more complex ways around the existing laws. And I wonder if you have staff sufficient to begin to deal with that.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, we do not. The board has made legislative recommendations. I have not yet put them into a form where I met with the chairs or members about them, but I can tell you, and by the way, the board is going to revisit those once more on Tuesday, but I can tell you that one of the recommendations is that at such time as funding is available, that a high-level auditor investigator be added to the staff. We know of certain files already. In fact, I have a number of them in my drawer that suggest, based on what's been filed with us, that there may be irregularities. We know of other files where it's very clear that there were irregularities. And as a result of the new law allowing corporate participation in independent expenditures, and we have seen a churning of campaign dollars that we had not previously seen. And while one might be able to put together from the reports sort of the money trail, we don't have staff to do that analysis and thus to determine whether there's any need for investigation. Our resources right now are limited to investigating based on complaints or things that are clearly a violation on a filed report. Those are easy. That's a computer type audit and a couple of letters. But to do thorough investigations where we see problems or potential problems, right now we don't have the resources to do that.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, I guess the question I have is, are there funding sources aside from a straight general fund appropriation that we could use to augment that investigative function? Specifically, I'm thinking the court system, when the people who use the courts, the lawyers, complain that doesn't have sufficient funding. The lawyers pay higher license fees, and filing fees go up. And I wonder, rather than giving you an incentive to levy greater fines, whether we could just simply create a cost of entry that's higher for candidates, political funds, and anybody else who has to file in the first place. Whether there's been any consideration of just increasing the total funds available to you just for people to enter the campaign finance disclosure world.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I wondered if we would get to that topic this morning. Pursuant to statute last year, the board was required to do a report, which has been given to the relevant chairs and leadership, and I will make available, by the way, to any member who's interested in it. I have it available electronically, so give me a call or send me an email. I think I only have one copy with me today. The mandate of that report was limited. It was to look at whether the checkoff program that's currently used to fund public subsidy could somehow be structured as a way to provide funding for the board. I will summarize the report but provide some detail because I think it's important, as well as talking about the board's recommendations. First of all, we have to keep in mind that the checkoff program is really an allocation of general fund money by the checker offer on the report to the public subsidy program. It is not a donation. So to use that program to fund board operations would be no different than funding it through the general fund appropriation that we currently get. Wouldn't save the state any money. It might express taxpayer interest in providing money, but it wouldn't save the state any money. So the board felt that that was not a viable method. Besides, there isn't enough in that program unless it was increased to really provide our budget. But the board went beyond that mandate because we did want to explore additional options. And of the two options that might be viable, we looked at first a different form of checkoff program, something like the non-game wildlife fund checkoff, or I know there's legislation around, I don't know the status of it, I'm not following it, for other checkoffs that would be in the body of the tax form rather than at the top. And by in the body, that means it actually decreases your tax refund or increases the amount of tax you owe. And whether that mechanism might be appropriate for funding the board, we determined that there could be significant revenue generated that way. The Department of Revenue doesn't take a particular position, but points out that when you add additional checkoffs, the sole checkoff that's there now tends to decrease, although overall money donated increases. We did recognize that if that option were to be viable, some authority to spend money to advertise the program would probably be necessary. I believe the DNR spends $100,000 a year to advertise their program. In the end, the board recommended against that, as it did against the other option I'll talk about, primarily on the basis that the board believes that the appropriate source of funding is the general fund appropriation made through the legislature. I will be talking with the board on Tuesday about this because I believe that our position will be that if the alternative is a significant cut that would reduce staff or prevent us from eventually getting one additional staff member, that maybe we would revisit our position on that. Finally, the additional method of funding that we looked at was really a revisitation of the fee structure. The board was mandated, I believe it was in 2004, might be wrong, Jeff, 2005. First, we did a fee study where we determined how much of our budget was spent on each program, because constitutionally you can't charge fees that are in excess of the program costs. We made fee recommendations, and for 1 year the legislature implemented a fee schedule for lobbyists, and we did actually charge and collect from lobbyists. The board looked at that again and once again said that it was their belief that a general fund appropriation was the best method to fund the board, but at that time, at least, at the board meeting where they adopted that position, they did feel that of the alternate funding mechanisms, the members that voted that day felt that a fee structure was preferable to a checkoff program. I think that either one could be made to work. I would hope that if we implement either one of those, that the additional funding that we need to have this auditor-investigator position at a high level would be able to be included. Thank you.
Further, Representative Winkler?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, I don't know if your report contains detail on potential revenue generated by adding a fee for reporting or for filing, whether it's lobbyists or whether it's campaign committees. I mean, you have to pay $100 to file for office. It seems to me if you had to pay $100 to file with the Campaign Finance Board, it wouldn't be unreasonable. It's not a, wouldn't be a, if you don't have $100 for, you know, a filing fee for the Campaign Finance Board, you're not a viable candidate. So it doesn't seem like it would be a terrible burden. But I wonder if you have any sense of and it, you don't have to do it off the top of your head, but in the report, what kind of revenue could be generated by the filing fees and whether that would be sufficient to supplement your investigative function.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, the original fee study mandated a study that would generate 100% of the board's budget. I think part of the reason that program never got implemented was because it resulted in fees for state party units of something like $200,000. Of course, these are multi-million dollar operations. I've thought about this very question quite a bit, and we have about 3,000 lobbyist principal pairs, that is, people that a lobbyist represents. If they each paid $100, which I think is a bit high, but that's $300,000. That's half of the board's annual budget. So it's not really that hard to get there. The amount of money that is to be raised dictates the amount of the fees to be paid. We have about 1,500 candidates. If they paid $100, that's $150,000. So the fee structure can be tailored to meet the needs, with the caveat in mind that we can't have one program pay more than its share. I believe it is constitutionally permissible to have one program pay its share while the state pays for some other program, for example, campaign finance, but we couldn't fund the whole thing by lobbyists, for example.
And the final, I guess, question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, can you give a rough idea of how many political funds, party units, and so how many filers you have who are not candidates or lobbyists?
Mr. Goldsmith?
I just turned to something here. I have that right here. I don't have that right here, but my recollection is it's about 700 political committees and funds and about 300 party units.
Thank you.
And Mr. Goldsmith, for what it's worth, I would agree with your board that the fee system is a better alternative than a checkoff, as one legislative opinion. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldsmith, of the investigations and complaints you currently have worked on, how many of them were brought to you by outside parties, and how many of them did you discover through the process of discovery in looking at the filings?
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, the matters that we investigate tend to fall into two categories. One is those that are kicked out by our computer audit system, which rely on filed data. So, for example, if somebody took a contribution from a legislator during the session, we know about that right away. Those are simple. They're handled routinely. More complex ones are primarily arise as a result of complaints, because they often do not rely on something that's obvious from the filed data. So I would say they primarily arise from complaints. The ones, and secondly, I might add that we're required to investigate a valid complaint if it states an action that actually would result in a violation. Whereas if we see something in a file that is suspicious, the statute doesn't require us to investigate that, and we will do it at such time as we have time, and with our current staffing, that hasn't arrived yet.
Mr. Chairman, so if we had a larger universe of participants in the political process expending money, including individuals, organizations, corporations, unions, you'd probably see a higher number of complaints brought to you. Tell me again, please, what we would do with, would the investigator just be a receiver for these outside complaints, or and I'm trying to figure out where this additional expense that I think some of the questions that we heard previously are talking about.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, the board, unlike a quasi-judicial organization such as the Office of Administrative Hearings, actually performs investigations. If you file a complaint with the OAH, you have to go there and you have to prove it up yourself. They're not going to help you. On the other hand, the board is required to actually investigate. So this position And the work that this position would do now is done by myself and Assistant Director Sigurdsson. This position would actually conduct an investigation. The complaint comes in, the executive director looks at it to make sure it's not specious, that it's not based on some guess or something picked out of the sky, that there are enough facts to proceed. If it's a close call, the board makes that decision, and then the investigation actually starts. So this person would be doing a fairly complex audit investigation process.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that process audited? I mean, in terms of, is there a look back on the things that you've heard complaints over the last couple of years, for example? Is your process of selecting those, are those audited, and by whom?
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're audited. I guess I wouldn't use the word audit. There is oversight. If a complaint is not accepted for investigation, the board is advised at its next meeting, and the letter of complaint becomes a part of our public records and is in the minutes of that meeting. If a complaint is investigated, it is investigated. The board does its work in executive session, and once the board reaches a conclusion, that those findings and the investigative file are then opened. So there is a review of it, but I'm not quite sure if that answers your question.
Representative Benson?
I guess what I was going to with the question is there's no outside agency audit. There's no other person or agency that comes in and occasionally looks at the processes and says, you know, everything looks okay, it doesn't look okay, there are some issues with what's been audited in terms of complaints, so on and so forth. There's no outside agency audit.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. Not of that particular aspect. The Office of the Legislative Auditor, of course, audits our agency primarily for financial controls and the use of the money, but it does a general audit of our agency. But no, there is no other agency that specifically audits us.
Mr. Goldsmith, you had some further information you wanted to share with us?
I do, and I don't have very many minutes, so I'm going to actually not give you the whole education about public subsidy, but I think if you look at the Visio diagram that I've given you, it really encapsulates how the money flows into public subsidy and how it flows out. We start with the checkoff on the left, which is running about $2.5 million every 2 years. It's been going down slowly over the last several years, so we wouldn't expect it to go any higher than that. Although that could be expectation could be defeated by a concerted effort by some political party to actually encourage use of the checkoff. On the right-hand side, we start with a $1.020 million appropriation every 2 years. So really, the cost of the checkoff of the public subsidy program is about 4.5 every 2 years. You'll see in the budget book that the figures are a little bit different because we don't spend all of that every 2 years. We pay out for those offices that are up for election and those that aren't carry forward to the next time that they are up for election. And I'll just mention then that the checkoff money gets paid partly to party units directly, but mostly to candidates. And the column on the right, which is the general account column, that's really the equalizer in the campaign finance system, because whatever is in the pool, say, for representatives in an election year, every representative of a major party who's running with a major party gets the same amount. So it equalizes incumbents versus challengers. On the other hand, the left column, the party account column, is based on who checked off from the district that the money came from. And so it tends to maintain the status quo with regard to party differentiation, although it also will flow with the changes as the makeup of the district changes. I'm not going to go through it any further. I will be happy to meet either individually or discuss by telephone how that money flows, but I really wanted to talk finally about the budget itself. I did provide a salary history graph. I mentioned already that we we cut our staff, and we did that not really because we didn't need them, but we foresaw what was happening with the budget, with staff salaries, and with the state budget as a whole, and recognizing that we weren't likely to get increases, although we did get a small increase that we asked for in the previous biennium, but we still saw what was going to be happening. And so we did cut from 9 to 8. We didn't cut out an investigator. We cut out a receptionist at the front desk, which we really didn't need because with everything online, we don't have very many people coming in. You can see the drop. It was between fiscal 9 and fiscal 10, and that was actually a 5.74% decrease in our salary costs. Salary makes up 83% of our budget, and the figures I've given you on the spreadsheets use the MMB projections for salary increases. Hopefully those projections will be too high. Hopefully the governor's office will be able to negotiate contracts that don't have the increases that are projected, but we use those because our guess is no better than theirs. After you take 83% for salaries, the next part of our budget is rent. Payments to the Office of Enterprise Technology for computer and voice services, including some internet hosting and internet access. That's 11% of our budget. That is 94% of our budget, which we really can't touch short of laying people off. And the remaining 6% is supplies, paper, and odds and ends. I'm hoping that somehow we, and I believe the other small agencies that I think are well managed, as we are, escape budget cuts. I hope that if a 15% state workforce reduction is put into place, somehow agencies with 10 or fewer employees will be excluded from that process. It will cripple otherwise well-functioning small state agencies. At least it will cripple ours. Finally, if we have to do these cuts, 15 or 20%, I want to just tell you what will happen. First of all, of course, we cut everything that's discretionary essentially to zero. We leave ourselves enough supply money to buy paper. Training and staff improvement development ceases, rulemaking ceases. Board meetings are cut from 12 to 6 or 8 per year. The executive director will have to have more discretion because we're supposed to either hear or lay over certain matters in 30 days, and we won't be able to do that on a regular basis. The service that we provide will be cut at all levels, depending on how many people we have to cut. And my second, the last four pages of your packet, in fact, the second from the last, really shows you these cuts. At 15%, we lose 1.7 staff members. At 20%, we lose 2.7 staff members. We reach a point of diminishing returns. When we laid off our receptionist, who was making under $30,000 a year, we had to pay her $300 a week in unemployment benefits. And that went on because we're self-insured. We pay it right out of our general fund budget. With all the extensions that were put into place, that went on for about a year. I talked to the unemployment people. If we lay off a person who makes $50,000, we could expect to pay $20,000 in unemployment benefits if they qualify to be on for a whole year. So we don't save as much as one would think just by laying off staff. Let me find my final page here. Just to conclude, enforcement efforts will slow down and stop. Economic interest program, the disclosure program, will go first. Phone calls to get reports and working with people to get reports will end. We'll get the reports that we get, and we'll send out the letters on the ones we don't get, and we'll impose penalties. We will send out letters to collect those penalties, but that will be it. It will be a rote pro forma operation, which is something similar to what it was years ago before we moved to a customer service model under Gene Olson's direction. The next program to suffer will be lobbying. Again, the work in the lobbying program will become pro forma. Letters will go out to get reports. We won't be able to make the calls to try to make sure everybody knows they've got a report due. The late filings will go up. Letters will go out. Probably late filing fees will go up. People requesting waivers of late filing fees with the board won't have staff there to work those waiver requests up to be in their best form to go before the board. We actually try to assist people in getting a waiver if they're qualified based on prior board action. People will have to come in and make their presentation to the board because we won't have anybody to write it up for them. And finally, the last program, because it's really the most important program, it's also the most labor intensive, the last program to be hit will be the campaign finance program. The level of services, particularly telephone services, will drop with two people. The compliance officer, Joyce Larson, who many of you may have talked to, may not be there. Marsha Waller, who handles our registration, may not be there. And there won't be anybody to take your calls. You'll be leaving messages. We'll maybe have hours where we're available. And we'll certainly return calls, but it may be 2 or 3 or 4 days. So a well-functioning agency that's known for its customer service will cease to be known that way.
Mr. Goldsmith, thank you for your good overview of your budget and operation. And, you know, I think it's good for all agencies to go through an exercise, what-if kind of exercise. And I, for one, am very much understanding and sympathetic to the impacts that you have identified here for small operations, important operations like yours. Representative Simon.
Just one quick question, Mr. Goldsmith. What effect, if any, on your office would reinstatement of the PCR have? As you know, 2 years ago we basically suspended it. It's still on the book. We just defunded it, chose not to fund it 2 years ago. If that were somehow reinstated, what effect, if any, would that have on the functioning of your office?
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that would have no fiscal impact and no employee impact. We have the receipt books, and our responsibility is just to hand them out, which we could start doing again.
Representative Kahn, we need to conclude here.
Thank you for something, or rather from my campaign treasurer. You're keeping the fax machines open past closing hours was a great benefit to us, so I want to publicly thank you for that. I don't know if everyone else works to the last minute, but we somehow seem to get to do that. So,
well, thank you again, Mr. Goldsmith, for being here. Members,
thank you.
Drive it to the end.
You're reminded that we're going to meet 30 minutes after session on Monday, 30 minutes after session, and we've got 3 bills that are up. And then we've got 2 overviews as well, so we'll have a full agenda. Probably need to anticipate a couple, 2-3 hours. So I wanted to remind everybody of that. Meeting adjourned.